That's why he didn't sign.
I mean, I think Rabbi Rosen heard it from a couple of people as the reason why he didn't sign. I mean,
interesting. All right, we're ready.
I didn't hear from anybody that necessarily heard it directly.
You know, we have, I'm talking to the Rothkopfs, we have a wedding coming up that, not a simple wedding, because it's in Haifa, and Malka's, it's on, right? Malka's sister's coming in, her nephew, and we got to work out how everyone's going to get to Haifa, and we're sleeping over, and then we're going out for Shabbos, there'll be Sheva Brachas, it's a lot of planning, and I leave it to my eldest daughter to handle. It's our fifth son. So, Kanayin Hara. All right, we're ready to begin. First of all, today is, February 3rd, 2019. Hard to conceive, but time is marching on. I want to welcome back Rabbi Rubin, who we all were praying for, and very happy to see him. Larichet Yomim Tovim. Refuah Shleima to Steve Bressler, whom I just spoke with, and he's still, the doctors say he's all fine, all the specialists, but the patient still does not have his strength, does not feel 100%. Coming back to last week, I want to say welcome to all those sitting here. We have Kibbutz Galya at various parts of the world. And Shavua Tov to all those listening across the wide expanse of the Torah world. Yomo, please check that everything is working. I want to make one correction for last week and admit I gained more knowledge. Make Talmidai Yotem Mikulam. If you recall, last week we were talking about last week was an important Sheyura. Talking about Rav David Zvi Hoffman, the Melamed Lahoil, a man that represents us as well, caught between two worlds, a great Talmud Chacham, Hungarian, German trained, and yet a modern individual living in modern Germany, the height of European culture. Who would dream what would happen just a few years later in the very city where he lived, Berlin? And I mentioned he said about going into the draft that Chas v'Chalila, we don't want Jews to avoid the draft in Germany. It will stereotype the Jews that they're not good citizens. And if you recall, we had some youngsters sitting here last week, the Ginsburg family, and I used as an example of stereotyping Jackie Mason. So I mentioned that Jackie Mason's original name was Mazur, and I think I was corrected by a student listening. His original name was Maza, M-A-Z-A. How I got the Mazur is when I learned in Lakewood, his name, it's not Jackie, his older brother was a Rav not far from Lakewood, and he came from a Litvish family. And in Lakewood, everyone knew the Mazur brothers, and that's the name I recall. But Maza happens to be a very prominent rabbinical name. 100 years ago, who was the Rav of Moscow? 120 years ago, Rav Yaakov Mazar. And there's a street in Tel Aviv, in the heart of Tel Aviv, named in his memory, Mazar. So I correct myself. However, what's interesting, once I got involved and I tried to find out who Jackie Mason is, and remember I told you I taught his nieces, and they wouldn't mention his name. They were so angry at him. So I said, look, it's true, he didn't live up to the family, but at least he remained a Jew. He finally married. He married a Jewish woman. He identifies with the State of Israel. So I did my research, and I have to correct myself again. I didn't believe he had smicha. I thought he was only a chazan. He has smicha from Rav Moshe Feinstein. Rav Moshe was very close to his father. His father's given a litvish Talmud Chacham, and all three brothers are musmachim of Rav Moshe Feinstein. So I correct myself there. On the other hand, I have to tell you, I had great joy reading the Wikipedia entry. And again, I trust the Wikipedia is reliable. Now, as the Britannica, you know who wrote the article. Here, I really don't know who wrote the article. And I know with the article there's an entry on a guy named Amirat Kefet. It took me a while to find out who wrote the article. Why was it important to me? Because I had I made two corrections, as I recall. And then, as years went on, I edited material and I knew who to contact. So I find out from the article that he was a great friend and supporter of my Madrichin B'nai Akiva, Meir Kahana. And even after Meir's death, he continued to support Meir. And when you'll see my new book, Be'ez Rav Hashem, you'll understand why there is a smile on my face. Okay. Then I want to mention something else that's very, very important. YU has a publication society. They've published quite a few books in Halacha, the Rosh Yeshiva, the faculty. I believe it's called, the Keren Michael Shaf, Lotzat Svarim. And a book just came out. I want to acknowledge Rabbi Yonah Reese sent a copy. And I consider this the most important volume that YU has ever printed. This volume is exactly what I've been talking about for the last 40 years in this classroom. It deals, Rabbi Yonah Reese is the Av Beit Din of the Beit Din in Chicago. Rabbi Wiener knows exactly who I'm talking about. And Rabbi Reese is a YU graduate. He taught in YU, was a Rosh Yeshiva. For a while he was the Menahel of the Yeshiva. But now he's really found himself where he belongs. He was the head of the RCA Beit Din. He ran the Rabbinical Council of America Beit Din. And here he deals with all the problems that are so much part of our life, such as Geirut Bisman Hazeh, Aguna, Mamzeirut, the Twin Towers, how are you matter, the women who have no idea whatever happened to their husbands, nothing is recovered, no bodies. And he brings all the sources and he consults with Rabbi Avadya Yosef, he consults with Rabbi Avadya's son, the present chief rabbi. But I have to tell you, there is one very sad part to this book. When you talk about Aguna and Mamzeirut and Geirut, we're dealing with problems. A guy named Rakefet spent years and years lecturing on these problems. Some of it shows up in published writings, Rakefet Aaron Chelek Gimel, which comes out of East Brunswick, and my dear Talmud, Rabbi Dr. Yaakov Weinstein, and in Chelek Balad, which will be out by the summer, I trust. More material. But there's something in here which is unfortunately a new first in rabbinic literature. And I don't know how to translate that, but God have mercy on us that we've reached this stage. Do you recall a rabbi, a YU graduate, a Bronx boy, very highly thought of? I was introduced to him at the Kotel many years ago, and I was told this is an up-and-coming Talmud Chacham, and he took charge of all Geirut conversions for the Rabbinical Council of America. He was one of the main people involved. Rabbi in Washington, D.C. I davened in that shul. From that shul, you could walk to the White House, to the Capitol. Very famous people davened there, Shomer Shabbos people, including a Senator Joe Lieberman, who was a candidate for the Vice Presidency of the United States. Many famous, wonderful people, including my own students. I taught from that shul. Anyway, here you have black and white, the total description that a rabbi set up a camera in a mikveh. I can't even go further. I don't want to spell it out, but you all know what I'm talking about. And he's in jail right now. By the way, you should know that the United States Federal Penitentiary has utilized him very constructively. He's teaching, same thing in Israel. There are many convicts who never went to high school. And the idea between, if you're an expert in the penal matters, and I think Mark knows something about it, the idea is to re-educate them that they should come out and not be convicts and should be good citizens. So the idea is give them a high school education at least. Maybe they'll go on to a community college and get a profession. And he is teaching high school in the jail. That's what I've been told. But what does this have to do with Kanfei Yonah? the Shaila comes up, what about all the conversions that he did until he was exposed? Can these conversions be accepted? That is he eligible to be the Av Beitin that he was? Is he a Shomer Mitzvah? How do you view him? Can he be part of the Beitin, the conversion and all that goes with it? And I have to tell you, this is a new first. I don't say I've seen every response ever written. I certainly haven't seen as many as Rav Ovadia Yosef, Lo Amoritz Anochi. I do admit I've seen over the years tens of thousands of responsa, but I want to tell you, this is a new first in how low a rabbi can sin.
What's the age?
No, he's not there. Well, you're going to, how can you pass a lot of conversions? B'shas Maisa, we hold he had a cheskat chazaka that he knew what he was doing. All right, today's a very important shiur, but I want to move on. I want to finish out, as I told you, Rav David Zvi Hoffman has two shuvot on this very issue. Are you people familiar with Hebrew and rabbinic? I use it in. I don't bother to explain myself, but if I say something that you could just raise your hand, and I'll explain. I once had that at. You know, I'm used to teaching to certain level of students. So I once was at the leave it to Chabad. They run a retreat once a year in Palm Springs. It's a 10-star hotel, not a 5-star hotel. And they're like a 1,250. It's so organized, it's beyond words. And I don't know how their women, all the Rebbetzins and all the young girls, it's like a Hollywood reception. Everything is beautiful, and they're telling you where to go, and there are 5 lectures at once. And I'm lecturing, and this beautiful little old lady raises her hand and says, Rabbi, I want to apologize, but I really don't know Hebrew. So I made a deal with her that in every lecture I give, she should raise her hand, and I'll know right away it means translate. Now, here, Melamed Lahuel, Mem Bet. Very interesting what we did last week. And he says, if we don't go into the army, it will cause endless anti-Semitism, will be stereotyped. Go into the army. You have to be a good, loyal citizen, under the word loyal. We'll come back to it later today. The next Shuvah, Mem Gimel, is to his brother-in-law. And here, the question is a little bit different. His nephew is evidently an Einer Ringe. Anyone know what that means? I asked someone, I asked a few people who I thought knew German, no one could help me. If Charlie, my student tomorrow, I have one student who's German, but again, he's born in America, so his German has long since been forgotten. Dr. Charlie Hexter, could you ask around what the word means? What I think it means, an apprentice. He's evidently studying something or doing something in his work where he's an apprentice, and therefore they don't draft him right away. You have 2-3 years to finish what you're doing. It's like every army, for instance, the State of Israel. I have one grandson, Dafka, the one who's getting married, is my only grandson who didn't do Hezda. This kid was graduated high school when he was 16, a bright kid, and he was learning in the Alon Shvut for a year. He was 16, so he had a year free. And he wanted to do Hezder in the Gush, and the army approached him and pleaded and asked him, cajoled him to become an Atudai. You know what that is, right? Atudai, it's a modern Hebrew word, Lashon Atid, future. They pay for your education, and you study what the army needs. So he studied in the, he's graduating the Technion this year. So technically he's a soldier. He did basic training when he, at the end of 1 year of Technion. But in reality, he's not a soldier at all. He's a regular student in the Technion where he met his wife to be. And next summer, when he's finished and he has the bachelor's, he does officer's training, and he has to give the army a minimum of 5 years. His father, my eldest son-in-law, who you know, was the same story. He was a Machon Lev graduate on a Tuda'i, he had to give the army 5 years. It turned into 20 years. But the army's not stupid. They'd rather have you in the field of specialty, if you have the ability, than another foot soldier. So here, that's what I imagine it is. But I'll accept any information. Erin Erringer, you see, and you always in response literature, you find this problem. Any of you who've studied the Rishonim, Vic, Rishonic response literature, there's a word, marufia. And I challenge you to explain that word. I went to Bernard Revel Graduate School. I heard endless lectures. No one knows for sure what it means. We think it means monopole, a monopoly, okay? Be a written monopole. I think in English the word is a monopoly. Is there such a word, or I'm playing with the game? But in Hebrew, it's monopole. And they think that's what marufia means. For instance, Reb Moshe Feinstein writes about a car. No, who knows, in 1,000 years? No, people will know what he's writing about. In modern Hebrew, you have to write mechonit. But the same thing here, when he wrote this word in German, he figured everyone will know what it means. So anyway, his nephew is an Erringer, and he's exempt from the army, but when he finishes, he'll have to go into the army. So his brother-in-law turns to David Zvi Hoffman, the Malamed Laholiel. Maybe my neched should go in now, end what he's doing, go into the army. That way he'll be able to get married sooner. Evidently, in those days, it's not like Israel. My grandson is going into the army, and Be'ezrat Hashem, in a few weeks, less than a few weeks, he's getting married. Today, it's a different world. You get married, you go into the army. The army has to pay you more if you're married. But on the other hand, the army probably goes with the viewpoint that if you're married, you're more responsible. So there's something to it. It's good to pay more and get a more responsible soldier. But evidently in Germany it was not the custom, the know-how, to marry and then go into the army. So now he turns to his brother-in-law and he says, there are two values here. One value is to get married for Ravuda, have children. Remember, that's the basis of our life, of our continuity, of our revenge. I tell everyone, revenge from Hitler, you understand? You have problems today with all the divorce. So I have a student, more than one student already said to me, why should I get married and be another divorce? I say, why do you look at the negative? Look at the positive. But the greatest event, I have students with 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 children, 13 children, my niece. It's revenge from Hitler. Look at it that way. So it's a very positive thing. Without Prua Ravu, none of us would be sitting here. All right? On the other hand, Chilul Shabbos, you're going into the army, you're going to be Mechalel Shabbos. And this is exactly his question. So the Malamed Lahoyel begins, Chilul Shabbos is a terrible sin. And there's no such concept that Chilul Shabbos is more important than Prua Ravu. Imagine if someone said to you, I have to take a girl to Las Vegas on Shabbos and date her, and what the heck, I'll forget about Shabbos, but this way I'll wine and dine the girl and I'll marry her and I'll have children. There's no such equation. Shabbos is Shabbos. And there's no concept that I should be Mechalel Shabbos now so that I'll be able to observe many Shabbatot in the future. That concept only exists by Pikuach Nefesh. If someone is, God forbid, sick, Hillel HaZaken, right? The famous Gemara where they find him on the roof and he's frozen stiff and he didn't have money to pay to get into the base. Very interesting Gemara. How do you charge money to get into the base medrash? It's an interesting question. But you see that when you give it away for nothing, it's worth nothing. Ask you the Megan Muggin Shavya. People don't treat it seriously. That's why in Shvut Ami, many times we translated so many books into Russian. I write about it in my new book. You'll see what I have, the translations. And I raised the money. It was no big deal. People were happy to honor Malkin myself. We risked our lives in Russia, so people we grew up with in Bnei Akiva and made it big in America were happy to sponsor books. But when we distributed them, we always charged something, a little bit. The idea was we found if you give it away for nothing, it's not taken seriously. So we always charge something. Right, this may be one approach. Another approach may be that there were too many phonies around and they enjoyed getting into the Beis Medrash. The building was warm, so in order to weed out the pseudos and the phonies, we charged. But anyway, Hillel Zaken was found frozen. So there, Yavadi, Machalo Shabbos right away, so that he'll be alive, that he can go on living. But here, to tell someone, I'll go into the army, I'll be Machalo Shabbos, but that way I'll get out quickly and I can lead a normal life and do mitzvah. There is no concept like that. But then he reverses himself and he says, what are we talking about here? Chilul Shabbos? Who says for sure you're going to be Machalo Shabbos? Maybe the army will realize you're a frum Jew and enable you to be Shomer Shabbos. And he mentions that, you know, that things have changed in Germany and they're more liberal to the Jews now. Could you imagine he's writing this 100-plus years ago? And we know cases of soldiers where they permitted them to be Shomer Shabbos. So quoting the whole Gemara, the whole sugya about going into a boat 3 days before everything we've spoken about the last month, he says, what's there to be concerned with? You're going into the army. The Chilul Shabbos is not immediate. And perhaps there won't be Chilul Shabbos at all. But your going in now has nothing to do with what's going to happen later. And as far as you might say, well, what am I going into the army and rushing it and doing what I have to do? And then I'll be able to marry. He says, maybe you'll die, you're worried, you'll be Machalo Shabbos, you won't survive. No one worries about that. Cheskat Chayim, a person's alive, he's alive. The greatest proof is the Gemara. The Gemara says you can get on the boat 3 days before, you don't have to worry about Shabbat. Wait a minute, yeah, and you're going L'dva Mitzvah, you're allowed to get on the boat even on Friday, a minute before Shabbat, right or wrong? Who says you're going to live? Who says you're going to get to the L'dva Mitzvah? But we never worry about that. We take a Cheskat Chayim and absolutely you do what you have to do. A person has to live normally and you can get on the boat, you can go into the army. And Malchut Shel Chesed, this is the word he uses, the word that everyone uses about the United States government. This is the word he uses about the German army. And he says something else. He says, I'll give you another reason for going into the army now. You're younger. You're not as strong. Doesn't say how old the kid is. I know in the Israeli army, once you're above 20, 21, no one is looking at you. In my days, I did basic training at the age of 38, 1976. But in my days, it was after the Yom Kippur War. There were under 2 million Jews here. The army took everyone who could walk upright. Until the Yom Kippur War, they didn't touch Americans. You know, dual citizenship, the State Department objected. When you got your notice of induction, you had to write a letter of protest and send on a copy to the State Department. I'll be very honest with you, I engaged in chicanery. I wrote a letter of protest, sent it on to the State Department like I was instructed by the Israeli draft board, but I never sent the original letter on to the draft board. You follow me? I didn't have the heart to protest. I had the schut to be the first Rothkopf after 2,000 years of exile going into the IDF. I couldn't send the top letter, so the copy was taka sent. It's somewhere filed, I don't know where. But that's what we had to do. But after the Yom Kippur War, they didn't play games. They took you, whether you liked it or not. But nowadays, Baruch Hashem, we're a much larger country, a bigger country, a wealthier country, and there's a limit how many soldiers you need. You know, when all is said and done, in a modern warfare, it's more the brains that you need than the soldiers on the ground. Everything today is computerized. A different ballpark. I can only tell you in 82, when I won my medal for being in the Lebanese War, the first Lebanese War, So I was right near Damur, right right in the heart of Lebanon, and our forces had moved right there, was near Sultan Yaakov, and the battles had ended now a day earlier, and what they do is they have a safety parameter where tanks go up and down with Dach Porim. How do you say that in English? Dach Porim. They dig out the ground, they make a path. Dach Porim, that's to be a word. New Mark, a big tank with a big shovel in front of it.
A tractor?
I don't know, it doesn't sound strong enough. But a Dach Por goes down. So anyway, they make it, and then there's a patrol going by every 5 minutes to check that there are no footprints. That shows that no one has come over from the enemy. And right there, I spoke, and then the choir of the chief rabbinate entertained, and then the commander, Baruch Hashem, we hit it off, so he gave the lieutenant colonel, who was in charge of that whole, gave me a tour of the area. So here I am between two mountains, and all the anti-aircraft is right there, and all the heavyweight guns right there between the two mountains. So I very innocently ask him, how do you shoot between, how do you see, how do you do that? He says, Hakol Michshuv Hayom. Everything is computerized. Now, this was 1982. Vic, imagine where we've gone today since 1982. You follow me, Yomo? And I was like a yo-yo, you know? I couldn't believe it. He said, all right, and thank God they didn't have to shoot while I was there. But everything is computerized. And more so and more so. So it's a very fascinating. Here he tells him, you're young, you're not so strong. The army will take you. There's not too much they can do with you. But in a few years you'll be stronger. You may be used in more dangerous positions in the army. Better to go now than to go later. All right, this approach, I would say very simply, don't publicize it. You follow the idea of doing as little as you can is not exactly going to win the Jewish community an award in Germany at that time. Now, it's very interesting at the end, he says to his brother-in-law, and this I've spoken about many times in great depth, when you get a question like this, and you're the first one to deal with it, so he says to his brother-in-law, look, I'm willing lahatir, let him go into the army, but Chilul Shabbos is very overwhelming. It's the heart of Yiddishkeit. I don't want my heter to be operational unless another great posek agrees with me. And that's the way he ends off the tshuva. That show it to another great rav, a posek, and if he agrees with me, then my tshuva is halacha lemaseh. And this is all the time, we have to be humble. We have to understand, as smart as we are, we don't rule the world alone. It's very, very important. And you all know, for instance, I write about it. By the way, in the next volume of Rakhafer Aaron, this is all in the volume. It's not in what Rabbi Dr. Weinstein worked on. It's the two chapters that were edited into one and left out of my work Washington, so the Washington wouldn't be over 600 pages. And I always felt bad that these chapters were never totally published, and now I'm privileged to publish them. And I write about the Aguna. Out of this classroom, I was able to permit an Aguna. I mean, I would only repeat the story now. I've said it a number of times. It will all be in print. Rav Avadja published, but when Rav Avadja agreed with me, Rav Avadja Yosef, and Rav Avadja was a posek par excellence. It hurts me that the world knows of Rav Avadja as the politician. And I always tell everyone, you have to separate the eternal Rav Avadja from the local individual who got caught up in Israeli politics, and his mouth would shoot off, and you know, and you know what happened. He would speak Saturday night, and Sunday morning it's the first item on the news, what Rav Avadja said in the Bukharan section in the shul where he gave the shiur. And that's why you have to be careful what you say, because it's not like the old days where the Rav could speak to a classroom and no one knew what he was saying outside of the class. Today, anything you say is recorded. It's all over the world within minutes. But Rav Avadja, when he ended off the tshuva, wrote that because this is a revolutionary thought and we're being permitting a woman to remarry without chalitza, I want two other great poskim to agree with me. And I did get two other poskim to agree. Rav Shaul Yisraeli, Rav Shalom Mashash, I got two other great poskim to agree with Rav Ovadia. But this is par for the course. Now, what we're saying here, and when we're going to reach the Rav later today, Bezrat Hashem, what we're saying here touches upon an outstanding chapter in Jewish history, which is part and parcel of our life. Until modern times, the Jew lived in the ghetto. Who put the Jew into the ghetto? This is Rav Simcha Fol Hirsch, if you're familiar with the 19 letters, or the letters of Ben Uziel, whatever name you know them by. And there's a paragraph there in the 19 letters. Who put us into the ghetto? We didn't go into the ghetto willingly. We were forced into the ghetto. A Jew, the Torah commands a Jew not to live in the ghetto, to be part of the big world. Rav Soloveitchik and Ish Halacha, Milu et Haaretz v'kivshucha, conquer the world. And the Rav's whole approach in Ish Halacha is a Jew has to be totally integrated. We have to have great mathematicians and great scientists, etc. Well, in Christian Spain, the golden period, I should say, Islamic Spain, the Jew lived. It was a golden culture. It was not in the ghetto. And then the Christians came in, and we all know what happened, the persecution. And ultimately, the Jews are exiled from Spain. You have the Jews in Franco-Germany, the Ashkenazic Jews, and Italy, and the ghetto, and the Jews are forced in. And by the 1400s, 1500s, almost all over the world, wherever Jews are living, they're living in a ghetto. Many times later, the Jews were happy to live in a ghetto. It's like the Balei Tshuva. You think of Meir Shearim. Meir Shearim today, you take any other place in the world that's 140 years old, what is real estate worth? The buildings are falling apart. There's no breathing room. There's no parks in Meir Shearim. Where do the kids play? And the buildings are worth more than ever. In terms, you take something you bought in 1870 for the equivalent today of $10,000, today you pay $1 million for the same property you bought in 1870 or more. And the Jews, why? A Baal Tshuva, he's overwhelmed. He comes from Kalamazoo, Michigan. And here everyone is from the ghetto. It's beautiful, your shul, no cars on Shabbos. There's so much to be said for the ghetto. Look at Lakewood. Lakewood began a little yeshiva, nothing with nothing. And take a look how Lakewood expanded. So when you talk about the ghetto, yes, it's true we were forced in. But many times we chose. Now, along comes the Enlightenment period. You all know it went on in the 1700s. The world undergoes a tremendous change from the time when everything centered around the Trinity, and 1700s, where the world centers around man, the encyclopedist, and all that went on, the Reformation, the Renaissance. And when you have a world that centers around the man, not around divine thought, image, etc., then you look at the Jew and you say, well, who's the Jew? What is the Jew? Why don't we give him a chance? Why don't we let him out of the ghetto? Why isn't he part of the big world? And this is the great challenge that we face until today that has killed and destroyed more Jews than Hitler and Stalin did put together. It is a spiritual genocide. You come out of the ghetto, you're welcomed into the big world. Can you survive as a Jew? And this is a tremendous challenge. We still don't have the black and white answer. I don't have to give any examples. All of you know I can say it very simply. President Trump of the United States is zeicher and privileged to have something that 3 million other American Jews do not have. His grandchildren are Jewish and Shomrei Shabbos. And that little joke says it all. Now, no one put this stronger and firmer than Napoleon. Yitzchak, tell me about Napoleon. Do you know how many books have been written on Napoleon? Do you know what a machlokes there is? Was he an evil man? Was he a good man? What was his attitude towards the Jews? I'm not an expert on Napoleon, but I can tell you my own gut feeling is, and I've read a great deal, and it interlocks with some of my own studies, Napoleon really believed in a Napoleonic complex. He thought he had to change the world, civilize the world. And he was not an anti-Semite. His attitude was, if the Jews are willing to work with me, come out of the ghetto and be decent, I'll do everything I can to help them. And this is why French Hill is called French Hill. They say Napoleon, this is what all the history books say, that Napoleon, on his way to Egypt, his big battle, said that if the Jews will help me, I will build the third Beit HaMikdash. Right or wrong, this is what's attributed to Napoleon. French Hill here.
I thought it was General French. That's why they don't call it. I mean, they called it the Gebat Zarfim, but it's named after a guy named French.
This is what I've heard, that that's when Napoleon made the statement on his way to Jerusalem. It could be anecdotal, it could be apocryphal, but it certainly shows that Napoleon was not an anti-Semite. And as far as I know, there's no record of one Jew that was tortured by Napoleon, etc. But Napoleon understood, and he articulated it long before I could crack that joke about President Trump. He articulated it very simply. He said to the Jews, put up or shut up. Do you want to be part of the big world? Or do you want to remain in the ghetto? And on this topic, you can't go further than unless you know about the Sanhedrin. And the story with the Sanhedrin is very simple. Napoleon,
well, he was a very clever man.
Yeah, no, he had he was a genius, and he had good advisors. And you're taking the words out of my mouth. And he had good advisors. And he came up with the idea, I want the Jews out of the ghetto. I want the Jews to be part of the big world. But I want the Jews to understand they have to be good citizens. They can't go on living as Jews with a ghetto mentality. Now, when we talk of the ghetto mentality, Napoleon knew exactly what was going on. And what he didn't know, he had advisors. And they told them, we're going to change the Jewish people. But in order to change the Jewish people, you need rabbinic authority. And there's no greater rabbinic authority than when you use the word Sanhedrin, because it reminds the Jews of what once was in Ir HaKodesh Yerushalayim. Moshe, you with me? Have you ever studied about the Sanhedrin, Napoleon? Now, it functioned on two levels. He was very clever. And I agree with Yitzchak, but I don't believe Napoleon was clever enough to do this all. But he had good advisors. Functioned on two levels. First, he called an assembly of notables. We're talking, I'll be very brief with the details, talking 1806, 1807. The assembly of the notables were both rabbis and lay people prominent in the greater France area, including some of the countries that he had conquered. Wherever there were Jews, he asked them to send delegates to Paris. The assembly of notables, there were Rabbanim there, Gedolei Yisrael. I'll mention the name of the most prominent, the man who later becomes the head of the Sanhedrin, Rabbi David Sinsheim of Strasbourg, Alsace-Lorraine. Alsace-Lorraine was a magnificent Torah community that survived until the Hitler period. There may even be Jews in this class that descend from Jews in Alsace-Lorraine. Olal Nechama, there's a big shul in Yerushalayim that has made my neighborhood impossible for anyone, has made me into a paper millionaire. And the reason is very simple. All the wealthy French Ashkenazi don't want to go to the Riviera, Herzliya, that whole area there, Netanya, the beach. They want to go to Ahol Nechama. What's so special about Ahol Nechama? It's built, it's right next door to the President's Palace, right? You know where it is, Rehov Chopin, right around the corner. The back of Ahol Nechama is where President Rivlin lives. And it was built by a German community, reparations, not just reparations money, but expiation money. They wanted to do something that their conscience should feel they helped the Jews rebuild, and they paid for the entire construction of the synagogue. It's about 30, 35 years old now, 30 years old, and that attracts, why does it attract the French Ashkenazim? Because it's Nusach Alsace-Lorraine. Now, that's Rav David Sinsheim was on a level that the Chatam Sofer had tremendous derech eretz for him. So this Council of Notables was a real, it wasn't just people for political power. These were Jews who were the rabbinic leaders and the lay leaders. And Napoleon's Minister of Education presented 12 different questions to the Council of Notables. These questions, each one reveals the Jew. Are you more Jewish or more French? All right, I'll give you an idea. You want me to? I'll give you an idea of the questions. Number one, is it lawful for Jews to have more than one wife? Do you understand this question? According to the Catholics, a man shouldn't even indulge in sex, right? That's the Catholic religion. Sex is a sin. God have mercy on a religion where sex is a sin, and we see the results today. But that's their religion. And the Jews, so b'dieved, a Catholic can get married once, not allowed to get divorced, right or wrong? Isn't that part of Catholicism? You're married once. Not talking today, everyone already buys off the church and annulments. But you're not allowed. Jews, a man can have more than one wife, right or wrong? This puts the Jewish people down. At the time that Napoleon asked this question, let me tell you a little story, a true story. Of the BMT, 1970, we went to Eilat. The BMT, I went along with the crowd, I went along with the students. All right, we camped out on the beach. There was no hotels in Eilat, or very few, and BMT didn't have money to take kids to hotels. So we set up tents, and we slept on the beach. Every 10 minutes, a military patrol went by. It was then the Jordanian border. It's not like today where there's peace with Jordan and you can go back and forth. If you've been to Eilat, you know what I'm talking about. Thousands of Jordanians come into work every day in Eilat. So there's a patrol. The American kids go over to the Jeep, guns, Jews. These are kids coming from Flatbush. So one of the kids, Harari, I remember like yesterday, he starts talking with the guy, and these kids knew Hebrew. They had gone to Flatbush Yeshiva. He's Harari. So, they're cousins. Their grandparents had four wives. You know how many children you can have with four wives? Kanayin Hara. You find a shalilim. Figure it out. No, four wives. So we'll say 20 children. We're being conservative with a C, small C. No, you then take all the children. No, you're coming into the modern world. They're looking right at you. How many wives are you allowed to have? Is divorce allowed by Jewish law? And that's a very simple question. But the question goes much deeper. Part of that question, how do you recognize divorce of these French government. In other words, you're part of the big world. Divorce. In America, you got to get a civil divorce. In France, you have to get a civil divorce. How do you view the civil divorce? Is that sufficient? Do you need more? Are you a good citizen or not? Every Protestant gets a civil divorce. What about Jews? Question 3 was the most difficult question that Jews have ever been asked since God asked them to accept the Torah, and Baruch Hashem, we answered Nasev and Ishma. If Napoleon offered you his daughter, how would you respond? Are Jews allowed to marry Christians? Or does Jewish law prescribe they should only intermarry among themselves? Do you see what Napoleon is asking here? I mean, this is earth-shaking. And go and believe, go and see 200 plus years later how many fine Jews have married non-Jews and never looked back. Take Henry Kissinger, Father Gabay in Kilat Adat Yeshurun. His mother wore a shaitel. These are facts. I know Yekes who knew them intimately. Who's he married to today? And he has Aricha German told him, he's in his 90s, Nancy. As a Mieskeit habe ich noch nicht in mein ganzen Leben gesehen, but that's a different story. But just think a minute what we're talking about. My classmate, Lenny Stern, who's given maybe billions already to NYU, the Graduate School of Business, is named in his honor, threw away his Jewish wife and married another secretary, whatever it was, Rebbeinu Shalom. As far as I know, they're still married decades later, and invited Rabbi Norman Lamb, the rabbi of Jewish Center, the shul in which he grew up, invited him to the wedding, which was on Shabbos. Okay? No, look what Napoleon's asking here. Then, those are the first three. Listen to 4, 5, 6. In the eyes of Jews, are Frenchmen not of the Jewish religion considered as brethren or strangers? All right? I grew up in my neighborhood was one-third Jewish, one-third Italian, one-third Irish. All white at the time. It was before the Bronx burned down. And how did you view your neighbors? Are they your bosom buddies? Or right, we live, but we really don't live together. How do you view the Americans, the French, etc.? 5, what conduct does Jewish law prescribe towards Frenchmen not of the Jewish religion? How do you have to treat them? Are they equal to you? We'll see in a minute. He spells it out. 6, do Jews born in France and treated by the law as French citizens acknowledge France as their country? Are they bound to defend it? You follow? Can they grab you for the army? Mark is a lieutenant colonel. My son-in-law is a skanaluf. But what a difference where he is and where you are. Rebbeinu Shalom. 5 and 6, dynamite. How do you act to your friends, neighbors? Then 7, who elects the rabbis? 8, what kind of police jurisdiction do the rabbis exercise over the Jews? What judicial power do they exercise over them? This question crucial. Tell me, who's sitting in jail today? Some of Lakewood's finest. I have a sefer upstairs inscribed to me from a great Talmud Chacham. He's rotting away in jail today because he tried to force a recalcitrant husband to give a get. Right or wrong, they kidnapped him, they used a cow poke or whatever, an electronic thing, tortured him. He's rotting away in jail. Try to force someone to give a get, the Gemara says, Makinoto Adshe Toma Rotsani. You're allowed to beat the hell out of him until he says, I'm willing to give a get. The Rambam Paskin Slav Locha, look into Perek Bet of Hilchot Gerushin, I believe it's Halacha. Chaf, if I'm not mistaken. Am I right? What do you say, Moshe? Good, all right. I have a bucky here. I have a lot of confidence that Moshe is going to be a great Talmud Chacham. He's a young man already. He did high school. He did army. Did you do college yet? All right, you got to figure out what you want to do. Here in Israel, if you want to be a great Talmud Chacham, you need a light college. You got to have broad knowledge, but it's not like America where you have to have the whole college scene and you have to know that today is the great football game. What's it called? What's the word? Super Sunday, I think they call it today. I couldn't daven this morning. 530 million guys that are living here 30 years, 40 years, all right, I'm living here 50 years, and all these donkeys are talking about is the football game today. They're staying up tonight to watch this, that. What do you mean, rabbis? We're going to beat the hell out of people? There's law of the land. What I gave you now is a real example, a tangible example. But I'll give you another example. A guy refuses to give a get. So the rabbis decreed that he is in nidui. It's not cherem, but that you push him away, you can't give him an aliyah. You can't wish him Shabbat Shalom. He'll go to court and sue you for defamation of character, come up with some other idea. Who are you? What are you? Are you Jew or are you French? Wow. And it goes on and on with the rabbis. Is this power that the rabbis have, is this Jewish law or is it only a custom? What it means is very simple. That originally the rabbis never had this power, but since you're in the ghetto and there's a void, there's a vacuum, you're not part of the big world, so the rabbis took over. But if you're back in the big world, then forget about the rabbis, or at least the jurisdiction of the rabbis. 10, 11, 12 are their professions from which Jews are excluded by law. Again, in the medieval period, what did Jews do? They were involved in banking and loans. We'll see in a minute, usury. Ultimately, the Jews got involved in liquor. The whole concept in Poland, the only ones they trusted to make liquor were the Jews because the Jews didn't get drunk. So the lords who owned all the facilities wanted the Jews to take care of all the alcohol because they could trust the Jews to make it, to export it, to sell it, and to give them what's coming to them, whereas if they got involved with non-Jews, they'd be dead drunk dealing with whiskey. No? Can the Jew be a doctor, a dentist, a lawyer, an accountant? Is he excluded by law? Now listen to number 11. Does Jewish law forbid the Jews to take usury from their brethren? 12, does it forbid or does it allow usury in dealings with strangers? Plain and simple. If Napoleon takes a loan from you, you're going to charge him ribbit. But if Chaim Yankel takes a loan from you, you don't charge him ribbit? What kind of citizen are you? What kind of Jew are you? What kind of modern human being are you? And Napoleon absolutely pushed the Jews against the wall. And what he's saying, and by the way, from his point of view, there's nothing anti-Semitic here. He's saying, put up or shut up. You want to come out of the ghetto, you want to be part of the big world, you want to follow the example of Moses Mendelssohn, the first Jew in this area to come out of the ghetto in 1762, and he came out of the ghetto, he didn't even ask to come out, but the German government was so impressed, he won the contest with the best philosophical essay. He defeated Lessing, the great German philosopher, writer, and they said, please, we want you out of the ghetto. And ultimately, hundreds of thousands, millions follow Mendelssohn out. And now you want freedom in France, and Napoleon wants to spread this freedom to Holland, to Belgium, to all the countries he conquered. But are you Jews part of us? Or are you going to remain a people unto yourself? And these were the questions. Now, that was 1806. 1807, out of the Council of Notables, they convene a Sanhedrin. Two-thirds of the 71 members are Rabbanim. One-third are lay leaders. Almost everyone is religious. Almost everyone. The Rabbanim, Certainly so. And among the lay leaders, the overwhelming majority were religious. There were a few from Holland, I understand, who were more given to reform. But when they opened their mouth, they were put down. The overwhelming majority, we have to find answers that will not contradict Torah Hashem Tamima.
But you see, the questions that were said were purposely answered in such a way as the Jew had to answer about intermarriage, about usury, because the Goyim had the image.
Right.
The Jews are people that love to take money.
Right. We know Shylock. Shylock, you have to go further. And you know who deals with this in great depth? Our classmate, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik.
Right. And for the first time, there's a new definition of a Jew. The Jews themselves had to drop the national element and stick only with the religious element.
This is what Napoleon was forcing them to answer, yes or no. Now, how do you answer these questions? So I have to tell you, some of the questions were very easy, that a Jew cannot have more than one wife. They didn't go into the fact that this is a rabbinic enactment, Cherim de Rabbeinu Geshem. And certainly the Jews in France, who were the overwhelming majority at that time, if not 100%, were Ashkenazic Jews. It's a truthful answer. The Sephardic Jews could have more than one wife until they came to Israel. In Israel already, you're not allowed to have more than one wife. But I can remember from 69, let's see if you remember, that there were Jews who came in Aliyah from Arab countries with two wives. And there was one case in Ramat Eshkol where you remember, where one Jew had two wives and they got along with everyone. And people, he made a bar mitzvah, I recall, everyone went to the bar mitzvah. And you have to understand, having one wife, two wives, three wives, it's a social factor. In other words, you can't laugh at it. Obviously, if I would propose to a woman, let's say I'm a kid of 22 again, and I say to Malka, I want you to marry me, and I love you, but it's after Hitler, and we have to have more children, and I want you to agree that I can have three more wives, so the more children I have, the greater revenge from Hitler, she'd, spit in my face, charge me for a seltzer, had a Harry Golden's book go for 2 cents plain, and walk away and never look at me again. But if your mother came from a family where she was one of two wives, three wives, and they lived, they cooperated, there was no problem, there was no concept. See, today marriage is a lot more than just a monetary union, a sexual union. It's psychological union, an emotional union. You can't have two wives, it's one. The Rav was very makpid. He would never sign a heter meir rabbanim. He said it has to be symmetrical. If he can't remarry, if she can't remarry, he can't remarry. We've come a long way. So you could answer, fine, we're not allowed to have more than one wife. Now, divorce. So we answered, of course we will require a secular divorce. But in addition, we have to have a religious divorce. Napoleon has to accept that. It's not that we're saying anything wrong with Napoleonic court of law divorce. The question of marrying a non-Jew, that's where they double-talked Napoleon. And they answered, we recognize the marriage between a Jew and a non-Jew. What they were saying was, if they go to City Hall and get married, we have to recognize it. But it doesn't mean we advocate it. Now, you should know that Napoleon's people sensed that this was double talk. But they all agreed we got enough out of the answers of the Sanhedrin not to press it. Time will take its course. And lo aleinu, take a look today, the reform movement, there's no such thing, no problem whatsoever, Jew and Gentile. The conservative movement did a total about-face in modern times, we're talking the last decade, and welcomes non-Jewish spouses into the conservative temple. And they have all types of ceremonies where, let's say, the kid is being bar mitzvahed, So the father will make a bracha on the Torah, the mother will open the ark if she's not Jewish, or vice versa. The father who's not Jewish will lift the Torah up, they'll let him lift the Torah. All types of ceremonies. They've come full cycle. And Napoleon's people were smart enough, don't press them. But it was sheer double talk. When you come to the Frenchmen, here they answered loud and clear, we are Frenchmen. We are proud to be Frenchmen. We have to serve in the army. And remember, you're now opening up the floodgate. We never had questions about Jews dying in battle and the woman remaining an aguna throughout the Rikshonic period and the Achronic period. Never, ever did this question come up. By the 1800s, take every country as battles are fought. There are Jews in the front line. Women are left agunat. The world has totally changed. We are involved in every army in the world. You can make a who's who, including Russia, of famous generals, of famous pilots, Jews, totally Russified, totally Americanized, totally part of the great culture beyond them. And here they answered Napoleon exactly what he wanted. With the rabbis, again, very easy to answer, that the rabbis had jurisdictional power because there was no government. We were in a ghetto. No one took charge of us. No one cared about us. But today we are integrated, and the rabbis have, as Yitzchak said, solely religious, spiritual power. But beyond that, temporal matters, we are part and parcel of the French civilization. When it came to occupation, they answered exactly what the Jew would be happy to answer. We are overjoyed to be in every profession. The only reason we weren't allowed into multiple professions is because the Gentile world kept us out. But now, with the generous spirit of the French people, Napoleon's Republic, we will be happy to go into every profession for which we have the inclination and the abilities. And isn't that exactly what has happened? Take a look in the world today. Wherever you go, you'll see Jewish minds. Look how many Nobel Prizes. Look at the percentage. We are small little people in the world. And look at the percentage of Nobel Prizes that have come our way. And by the way, among the Nobel Prize winners are Shomrei Shabbos. You have to give credit. One of the women who won, Yelena, was a Rav's, a daughter of a Rav, a total Shomeret Shabbos. She won years ago in science. There's a lady in Israel, a Rosh Yeshiva's wife of Yeshiva Hezda, an Ulpana graduate. She is doing research. They say that she may very well be a candidate for a Nobel Prize with her research. I believe she's at the University of Tel Aviv, if I'm not mistaken. If I have the name right, it's Levenberg. But I've heard about her many, many times. But you can go on and on with these examples. But in the state of Israel, whatever you're doing is part of Israel. It's Binyan Haaretz, Yishuv Haaretz. It helps the totality of Jewish existence. In Chutz Laaretz, it may or may not help the Jews at all. Are you doing it as a Jew, doing it as an American? Who's getting the credit? What is your lifestyle? How integrated you are? Who is your wife? Where are your children? And they answered Napoleon exactly what he wanted to hear. The usury shaila, they answered with double talk again. New, tell me, Jack, you have a bank account here, you have investments here, you take interest, yes or no? You look at the end of the year, what have you done? By the way, this year, every year, I don't know, I lost money this year, so I can tell you my retirement fund went down something, 4% or something. You understand? But we all take interest here. We all hope we get interest. How do we, Moshe, how are we allowed? Het the risker. Every bank that functions in Israel, every form of investment, you have to check that it has a hetariska. I believe all the banks here have hetariska. The forms of investment, I would believe, Hachsharat HaYishuv, the other bigger institutions all have hetariska. So they didn't go into details. You know what hetariska means, that it's not interest, it's investment. You're sharing the profits or you share in the losses, which is absolutely so. So they didn't go into all the lumdus with Napoleon, but they told him a Jew is allowed to accept a reasonable bout of interest from a Jew and from a non-Jew. But they didn't bother to tell him that there's a big difference with a non-Jew we accept plain and simple, and with a Jew there has to be a hetariska. Now, why have I given you all these details on Napoleon's Sanhedrin? And by the way, it's a very fascinating chapter in Torah history and Jewish history. And when you look back 200 years plus later, you can see that these questions were practically prophetic in what would ultimately happen to the Jew in the big, beautiful, non-Jewish world when they accept us as equals. And we've never yet come up with the answer how we can totally succeed. And it hurts, because you can have the best chinuch in the world, and all of us struggle today. You know, it's a big topic. OTD, off the derech, off the derech. You have kids, and I say the Haredi world, I can understand. The kid gets a Haredi education, suddenly discovers the big world, and he's swept away. All right, I can understand it. But what about kids who got the best education, open, balanced, YU type? Or you take Israel, they best education, the best of both worlds, good rebbeim, good teachers, and preparing you for Torah derech eretz, Torah umada, Torah v'avoda, call it what you wish, being a Jew in the Western world. And nevertheless, a certain percentage of kids throw it away. And we all know it. It hurts. It hurts. I can tell you students, endless stories. Kids, one kid, he's in the New York Times, very successful, threw it away. Where'd he go to school? The best training. Another kid, again, fine schools. I don't want to mention the school, but the finest schools. Good teachers. Balance. No, either this way or that way. Some of our kids run away and go back to the ghetto. And that's the famous issue with Reb Aaron Lichtenstein. I lived it in this very kollel many years ago. They write about it now. I see in a volume came out about Reb Aaron Lichtenstein. I enjoyed it immensely. Chaim Navon, I believe, edited it. Beautiful volume, and it catches Reb Aaron. I mean, I could have added, I knew him as a kid yet, but Reb Aaron, in this volume, Reb Aaron was asked, and it happened at a press conference. So, you know, again, the word press conference is not the right word. It's a misnomer. Reb Aaron, when he would speak on contemporary issues, he called it a press conference. It's not that he was asked questions. He responded, and then there were questions afterwards. So, all right, maybe to a certain degree it was a press conference. So one time in the Gush, going back to the late 70s, early 80s, so a kid asked him, who do you have more in common with, the Jew in Meir Shearim or the secular Jew in North Tel Aviv? And Reb Aaron answered, what kind of question? The Jew in the Meir Shearim. And the kids flabbergasted, and they came back here in the kollel. One kid I had at Talmud had a brother-in-law, Abby Kelman, Rabbi Kelman. So he had a brother-in-law in the Gush, Kohn. And he says, Rebbe, how could he, Reb Aaron, answer? What do we have in common with the Jews in Meir Shearim? The Jew in North Tel Aviv? I have everything in common. We're modern. We're Israelis. We serve in the army. And this is the great challenge. And Ein Hachinami, I struggle with my grandchildren. Who do you have more in common with? And they don't start to comprehend, a Haredi Jew, a Hasidic Jew. They look upon him, I don't want to use their words, that they're apikorsim, they don't serve in the army, and they all know that it's a mitzvah to serve in the army. There's a great chasm here. But we have more in common with Mahalo Shabbos in North Tel Aviv? It's not an easy question. We struggle. And I salute Napoleon for putting this question on the table. Now, you heard Reb David Zvi Hoffman. He was living in Germany. And he already had this feeling in Germany, we have to serve. Remember, I showed you last week, he wrote an introduction. I'm writing this tshuva so that you will see that Jews are proud to be part of German culture, and there is no contradiction. And he wrote two tshuvot, ein hachinami. I don't think anyone has ever stated it better with unbelievable English, unbelievable understanding of culture than my own Rebbe, Moriah Rebbe, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. And if I can let the cat out of the bag, I'll tell you something very fascinating. Baruch atah Adonai Melech Olam Shekel Mi'Evet V'Ro. The cat out of the sack. When the Rav became a citizen of the United States, he gave a kiddush. When his daughter and son-in-law, Gedolei Gedolei Yisrael, went in Aliyah, they gave a kiddush. And that says it all. The Rav, coming from where he did, White Russia, Poland, saw the communists take over. The Rav had tremendous scars. It's something he never got rid of. I can tell you from my own responsibility with the Mossad, with Shaylut, someone is being thrown out on Shabbos. What should he do? The suitcase, Dalat tarrying, no Erev, Tchum, the Rav's attitude, there is no Shabbos for you whatsoever. The minute the KGB strung you out, do everything they tell you. In Finland, Shabbos will begin again. And the KGB used to specialize Putin. Throughout people I sent on Shabbos, Putin was the head of the KGB in Leningrad, and he met with, I can give you names. They still remember who it was, Putin, the same image, much younger. And they threw him out on Shabbos. And the Rav, like, was so frightened of the communist. And it comes across, I quote him in the Rav, where we talk about the rejuvenation of Yiddishkeit in Russia, and the Rav says, I can't believe it, I can't believe it. And then he comes to, and Germany, studied in Germany, and look what happened in Germany. His own professors became Nazis. Heidegger, I don't have to go any further. And he comes to America, and could you imagine, he comes to Boston, and he builds what he builds in Boston and creates a world of Torah and Maimonides and Yeshiva University and Rabbi Yitzchak Rubin and his friends from Boston. Could you imagine the love that this man had for America? I can never forget. See, Rakefit, you're a nice wife. You don't listen to your Rebbe. When I just poked fun at Kissinger, it hurts me. I have Yekkers in my family. They knew his parents. The Rav couldn't believe it. He used to say about Kissinger, I have special enjoyment. Could you imagine the Secretary of State speaks with a German accent, a Jew? He said, since Yosef HaTzadik, who was the Mishnah Lamelech, the Paro, we haven't had a Jew of such importance. Follow? The Rav was overwhelmed that he could hear that German accent. Kissinger never got rid of it. There's some actors, actresses, who are able to get rid of their accent, or they can have Germaline Dietrich, others. You don't know they ever came from Germany. But like Rothkopf, Rakefet, whenever he opens his mouth, everyone breaks into English. They don't let me speak my beautiful, polished Hebrew. All right, that's the reality. The Rav, oh boy. He was an American. And the greatest story, Rakefet doesn't have to quote anyone else. The Rav was sitting here. I was sitting here, right here, my book, Gemara, right on the Rav's desk. And Shir ends on Wednesday. That week Shir was Wednesday, Thursday. And the Rav looks at his watch. I'm reliving it. Tomorrow we'll say Shir. 9 o'clock. 9 o'clock. This is America. Who goes to class 9 o'clock? It's not Israel. Israel, 8:30. Everything's awake. Not in America. And this moron there has the audacity to say to the Rav, Rebbe, why so early? Favas hazeh fri. And the Rav, what's the matter with you, Arnold? Du weißt nicht was morgen ist. You don't know what tomorrow is. Thanksgiving Day. I promised my sister, this is the Meiselman family, I'll be at her house at 1 o'clock. Or 2 o'clock. I don't hold me on the time. And he made the cheshbon to the airport, LaGuardia, on the plane, 1 hour flight off the plane, picked up in the house. Thank you. You know how much is written in the name of Reb Moshe? Are you allowed to celebrate Thanksgiving Day? The whole, again, they don't know whether it's after he died already, so it's hard to know what the master put in what he did. Okay, so the Rav...
You left out part of the story.
What?
You left out the part of the story.
What part have I left out?
Up until that point, you would sit in the kitchen eating a sandwich while your family was...
Oh, you're talking about me? Yeah. No, that's not important, Dad. Okay. Until I was a kanoi, I never would let my... I told my mother, you want to celebrate Thanksgiving Day? Celebrate yet. Well, I wouldn't eat. I would eat a salami sandwich in the kitchen, not even the dining. Then I came home and said to my mother, tomorrow I'm joining you for Thanksgiving dinner. What happened, Arnold? What happened, Arnie? I was told about the Rav. Why can't you be modern like Rabbi Soloveitchik? Okay, but that's unimportant. What's important is kind of the Rav. Okay, now, here we're very blessed, and it's a student of mine that I'm proud of. On one hand, the other hand, I have it very upset with him. He's the one who started the letter from Chovevei Torah about God have mercy. Same-sex relations, 200 Frum Jews, including rabbis, signed on. And today, in part of the so-called Frum world, they have the attitude that this is God created man and woman, and sometimes the man loves man, woman loves woman, and therefore we can't condemn it. I can't go into it now. It sickens me. It's not true. Check your research. I've dealt with it live, and 2% of the world at most has a biological problem. The rest is sociological, physiological, mental, etc., emotional. Take my word for it. I can illustrate this 1,000 ways over and go online. But that Natty Helfka didn't, I'm upset with. He's a very wonderful person. Don't misunderstand me, but you have to know where you, what's halacha, where we can draw the line and where we can't draw the line. But he did a wonderful job here. Community, covenant, and commitment. Selected letters and communications. Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. Edited by Nathaniel Helfgott. Now, what happened here was, when the Rav died, so obviously there were endless letters that survived. So the word went out, who has letters? So I sent in some of my letters from the Rav. The wind-up was nothing that I sent in was printed. They made a decision that the letters shouldn't deal with a personal problem, but should deal with a general question that affects all of Judaism. So in the volume, there's very little. Since I had correspondence with the Rav on a Geirut, where there was a conservative Geirut. And the question was, I could get them to redo the Geirut, but on the other hand, I was worried there wouldn't be Shmirat Shabbat. A very delicate question. And the Rav answered me what to do, and essentially said that if you can redo the conversion, once the kid had a conservative conversion, I described it, it was basically done with the form of halacha, So the Rav said, you can't say that what they did was nothing. Redo it. At least there should be the form properly, and do as much as you can to inspire him to observe more. And the Rav said, and don't get involved in machlekes. Very interesting, he said, that nothing will come out of machlekes. Do it quietly and don't embarrass anyone, etc. So that letter was not published. I consider it very important. The other letter I had from the Rav, which I consider the Rabbi Listening Thomas, the most important letter the Rav ever wrote, that letter I published myself as an introduction to the Rav. In the first volume, you'll see it there. So then I have other letters, but nothing but greetings, personal matters. But here in this volume, you have a lot of earth-shaking material. Now, again, later this volume was translated into Hebrew, but this letter I'm quoting in English because it was written in English. So let me quote it in English. It's the what the Rav himself wrote, not a translation. Let me just give you the introduction and we'll break for today. It begins on page 23. It's the longest written responsum we have from the Rav. It begins on page 23 and it goes all the way through page 60. We do not have any other responsum from the Rav that is anywhere near this length. Again, I've told you many times, it's hard to know what he wrote and what happened and what was lost and what he didn't want to publish and what was probably destroyed. It's part of life. But this we have. During World War II and the Korean War, the Committee on Army and Navy Religious Activities, KANRA, Committee on Army and Navy Religious Activity, C-A-N-R-A is the abbreviation or the acronym of the Jewish Welfare Board, which included representatives of Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox rabbinic bodies, were assigned the task of procuring, endorsing, and supervising Jewish chaplains to serve in the armed forces. Now, I believe my mark, this goes on until today, right? It functions out of the Jewish Welfare Board, and it's...
The Jewish they knew the term, so they kept Jewish Chaplains Council, the RCA is a representative, but also they opened it up. So, Aleph Institute for the Chabad is also considered
I understand.
More than one endorsed now, but... most of us were through the RCA with the umbrella.
Right, through the umbrella. I understand. The Joe, yes, we have two chaplains here.
The JWB was recognized in World War I.
Right.
But the JWB changed its name to the Association of Jewish Community Centers. And so in order to stick with that, like Marina said, so they used the term, that's what the government recognized.
Right. Now what you have to understand is, the United States government, being a malchut shel chesed, cannot draft rabbis or priests, or imams, for that matter. You have to volunteer. A 4D exemption is divinity, and you're totally exempt from the draft. Now, in World War II, there was no problem getting chaplains. The reason was very simple. Hitler wanted to kill every Jew alive, and many good Jewish boys, including many Orthodox Jews, volunteered willingly for the chaplaincy. The Korean War, suddenly there are not enough Jewish chaplains. And the government is putting pressure on the Jewish Welfare Board. We need Jewish chaplains. We have this percentage of Jewish soldiers. And in 1950, they set a quota for 111 chaplains. And 37 were to come from Orthodox institutions. In other words, the Jewish Welfare Board had to certify them. They needed 111, 37 from Orthodox institutions. This is what the government requested. This is what the JWB felt would be equitable. Only 20 Orthodox chaplains volunteered. Now, this went on, and RCA, Rabbinical Council of America, which is the leading rabbinic body in the United States, is facing a very difficult problem. The right-wing yeshiva, and remember, if you recall my class lectures from Monday, by the mid-50s, the right-wing yeshivas are very powerful. Not too many fellas from Lakewood, Teir Vadas, Chaim Berlin, are interested in going into the chaplaincy. Chabad is a non-starter at this time. In other words, you cannot confuse what Chabad is today to what Chabad was in the 1950s when the Seventh Rebbe is first getting started. So RCA and RCA and Yeshiva University are two sides of the same coin. You're dealing with 90% of RCA, 85% YU graduates. They're meeting with Rabbi Belkin. It is, to put it in very simple terms, a shander and a chaper for the Orthodox. We don't have chaplains. Rabbi Belkin and RCA came up with the idea, quote, a voluntary, end quote, draft. Now, what does that mean, voluntary draft? I can tell you exactly what it means. I was already in the yeshiva. I lived the whole battle. I recall it vividly. There'll be a lottery. A goral. Is a lottery the right word in English?
Yeah.
Goral. You pick a number. And the higher numbers, the lower numbers, I should say, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Please volunteer for the chaplaincy. And if you don't volunteer, there'll be strictures against you. Meaning, you cannot have a rabbinic position, why you will not acknowledge you as a rabbi, why you will not recommend you. If you apply for a rabbinic position, why you will say you never studied there, you are going to face strictures. Now, where did YU learn this from? Anybody know? JTS, Jewish Theological Seminary, they introduced this concept of a voluntary draft with strictures. And I can tell you, I had a professor in Yeshiva College, Milton Offer, Professor Offer, Zichrono Livracha, wonderful teacher. I studied modern Jewish literature with him. And where had he come to Yeshiva College? He was a seminary graduate. He went into Jewish literature, refused to serve as a chaplain, and the seminary would not recognize him. And he wound up in Yeshiva College, where he taught for many decades. But there's where they learned it from. Now, there's one big difference between what the seminary could do and Yeshiva University could do. And that difference was halacha. Who ever heard that you're going to force young men to leave the yeshiva, leave their learning, leave their native surroundings, leave their parents, leave their spouses, leave their children, and go in to the American Army? And here you come to the unique relationship between Rabbis Belkin and Soloveitchik. And if you recall my lectures, I said this a number of years ago, and I say it again. Rabbis Belkin and Soloveitchik complemented each other. It was a perfect, perfect relationship. If you recall, they were both candidates for the presidency of YU. Rav Shmuel Belkin was elected, 1943. The Rav was upset, It was his dream. He was a young man. In retrospect, we all say, thank God he wasn't elected. Look what the election did to Rav Shmuel Belkin, and look what not being elected enabled the Rav to accomplish. But that's with hindsight. In 43, 44, the Rav was upset. And Rav Shmuel Belkin told him, quote, I heard this from people standing there. Beryl, I promise you, ich gebach mein Wort, I will raise the funds for the yeshiva. Your task will only be to teach. You'll have nothing else to worry about. And that's exactly what happened the next 40 plus years. And it was a perfect partnership. The Rav could go on to become the Rav. The Rav could go on to create Torah. The Rav could go on to create students. And Rav Shmuel Belkin carried the whole burden, which ultimately destroyed him physically, and always regretted the day he left the classroom, Reed, Washington, by someone I know, where I quote from Rabbi Belkin's writings how sad he was that he stopped teaching. Now, Rabbi Belkin can only do what he did because the Rav covered him, supported him, gave him approbation, haskama. To pull off this voluntary draft, the Rav had to agree with Rabbi Belkin. The Rav not only agreed, but he wrote a magnificent letter where you just are overwhelmed by the Rav's English, command of language, the sources. We knew he was a Gaon, and it's going to lead us into a question that we've raised intermittently over the last 40 years. When you approach a halachic problem, are you in a laboratory that's totally clean of any germs? Nothing influences you? Or when you deal with a halachic problem, you're dealing with life. And as the weekend papers said here in Israel, dealing with Mandelblit, if I'm pronouncing his name right, that no one can issue a legal verdict without being influenced by the world around him. Let the question hang fire. I wouldn't miss next week's shiur for all the falafel that's not being prepared throughout the state of Israel. You know, in memory of the Holocaust, that Jew who survived Falafel Day, you know what I'm talking about, last week? Beautiful. When he came in Aliyah, he was so happy to be here, and every day on the yard site of his Aliyah, he eats falafel to show a survivor of the camps can be an Israeli. And now B'nai Kiva picked it up, and they, many kids ate falafel on the yacht side of his coming here. I think he was on one of the ships.
The Aliyah or the day he got out of the camp?
I think it's Aliyah he celebrates. I think he was on Exodus. He was on one of the famous ships called the Alta Naya, the Naya Alta Naya Milena, whatever it's called. Okay. Wonderful Jew. Okay, what do we do today? The emotion overwhelms me at times.
Are they selling this book?
No, I'm not selling it. I need the book.
You.
Is it the CRC?
Mark can get it for you. Mark brought me and I have an inscribed copy. Halavai should live up to what this great Talmud Chacham writes about me. But okay, what can I do? I'll show you tomorrow a haskama I just gave. And it's already on the internet. I can't believe I'm the only one in the world who gave haskama. You'll see. I'll talk about it tomorrow. Okay. What did we do today? All right, we finished out the Malamed Lahoil, the Sanhedrin, which is, it can be researched and researched again and again, but I have to say, 200 years later, Napoleon squeezed our neck and said, make up your mind. Are you a Jew? Are you part of the big world? We still don't have the perfect answer how to balance the two. In Israel, it's easier because being part of the big world is being a good Jew as well. Okay, Yitzchak, I have stuff for you. Get past this back to Yitzchak. This is 3 weeks. Pass this to Moshe. Moshe, tell your grandfather you can get a lift. If anyone's interested, I Xerox this from Reb Ovadia Yosef, Yechaved Dat. It deals with whether a Kohen can go to Kever Rachel or can go to the Kever Avot in Hebron, Marata Machpelah. Can Tzaddikim be Metameh or can't they? That's for... One second. He's not here today. Chaim. Moshe, can you take that for Chaim? Goldberg.
The whole thing?
Yeah. Here's an article from the New York Times. I have a lot of material on the Holocaust because it was just the International Holocaust Day. This is about the Sosa Mendes, if I'm pronouncing it right. This is another non-Jew who saved thousands of Jews, brought them to Portugal, fought the establishment. He should be as well known as Oskar Schindler. The Canadian National Archives, this is fascinating. They just acquired a manuscript, they paid for it, a Nazi study on North American Jewry. It seems the Nazis were going to kill every Jew in North America when they conquered American Canada, and they wanted a study done. Who are the Jews? Where are they? How many are they? This is on the young Lubavitcher Rebbe, that's the picture, and it's a tshuva he writes to a student of his in the 50s, a Chabadnik who shaved his beard in order to find the job. You follow? And boy, does he tell him off, but in a nice way. The Rebbe was very smart. This is very interesting. If anyone has been to the great Jewish museum in Moscow, Russia just had a Holocaust Day there, and one of the leading Russian people spoke against Holocaust deniers. But what's very interesting are the pictures. And if you've been to the museum, you'll recognize what you're seeing. Here's another great hero. This is from Canada, a Jew from Budapest, a Catholic, how he saved Jewish families. And he winds up in Canada along with another family that he saved, and they become very close. The Jewish family calls him Uncle Tibor. Very fascinating article. Right, this is the reality in America. Alarmed and armed, even rabbis are carrying guns. It deals with the post-Pittsburgh massacre, getting into shul through a metal detector. Guts are up in what we're up against. Lou, what do you think of this? On the way to Auschwitz, I found Heil Hitler signs for sale. You understand? It's become an industry. Not necessarily anti-Semitic, but you can have it. I grew up in my house. There was a Nazi knife that my father's cousin, fought in World War II, and he had a knife, and it was hanging on the wall with a swastika to show what we conquered. Who knows? The only thing, when my parents died, I told my brothers, you can have whatever you want. I just want one picture, which hangs in my office. The picture of the generals of the Six-Day War. The victory picture with President Shazar. How did my father get it? He davened during the week in a shtibble that was identified with Satmar ideology. The people there were Bellum Parkway Jews. What did they know about Sapa? But it's a nice Rebbe, Rabbi Oshri, and survivors. So they raised money for Israel. Every shul that raised money for Israel during the Six-Day War got a gift, this picture. So the Rebbe said, no, I can't put this up. I'll be put in Cheirim by my people. So my father said, you know what? I'm giving you $100 for the picture. The Rebbe was overjoyed. He sold it to my father. And you can look at it. It hangs in my office. 2 minutes, a half minute from here. Joe Liebman and Jack Liu on faith, leadership, unprecedented chaos in D.C. Two from Jews who are high up in government. And finally, if anyone's interested, what I printed out on Jackie Mason. And Jackie, if you're listening, I invite you to come to my shir and embrace your father and your brothers and all that's good that has sustained us until today. Belave the nefesh, and you can still be Jackie Mason with a good sense of humor, but Torah and Derech Eretz. I wouldn't miss tomorrow's class where we see how the Orthodox shul develops, getting ready for the modern rabbi. Some of those rabbis sitting right here in this room. Until we meet again in health and happiness tomorrow morning at 9:05 a.m., Das Vidanya. Mark, when do you go home?
Next Motzei
Shabbat. So you're still here. Okay.
It's Machlokas Achronim.
Machlokas Achronim on?
And French Hill. Okay, I got something here. Wait, how do I get rid of this stuff? French Hill is home. French Hill is named after British General John French. But he never served here. The main consensus is that he was named. It was named after the Catholic monastery of Saint Anne, which owned the land and whose nuns were primarily French. I got something else. But I'll show you a picture of that.
What did they talk about, Napoleon?
No, not Napoleon.
Samora Derech. I don't know. I heard it from so many people that. It's not Jack, any question?
Yeah, so the answers were given by the Sanhedrin.
Right.
Among the leadership, the intellectual leadership, the political leadership of French, what kind of reaction? Was there hostility? Was there...
No, the reaction was very satisfied.
Very, no
hostility.
No anti-Semitic.
No. And they said you got more than you could hope for.
This is general reaction. Is that surprising?
That's General French.
Okay.
British general.
And the monastery would be...
There's always anti-Semitic around. Why was
they
it...
They owned the land.
Look,
he never served here, but
these people were not dummies. They were his advisors. If the Jews already double-talked on marrying a Goya, give it time. No. Well, that's the rest of the history. Did the Jews integrate? Didn't they integrate? You know very well the Jews in France were in the 1900s, they became the most assimilated Jews in the world.
There was no hostility.
No, they accepted it. They accepted it.
Rabbi Mason, Jackie Mason's brother, was the rabbi in the shul next to South River, which is right next to East Brunswick.
Right.
He was the one who was very much involved in the setup of the original. Young Israel of East Brunswick.
I know when I lived in Lakewood that one of the brothers was someplace in Jersey. That may have been the brother, but back, it has to be the 50s.
There was a Saint Anne and the nuns were
Are you going back
French.
This week? So if I don't see you tomorrow, please tell Yaakov I'm working on the pages and the corrections. His part of the book is basically fine because he gave him a computer printout. It's everything that comes afterwards. But not too bad. I already did 150 pages. But now I'm dealing with the hard part, the pictures, the order. So it's going to take me another few weeks. Then I have to give it back and see that the corrections are in, and then we'll sign off. A lot of money was given, you understand. We can't make fools out of it. It's worse than you think, because with me, I lost a fortune of money. The Wolf Center Foundation gave them hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. And suddenly they stopped. This is a very, very hard thing. Because our work in Russia, it's compromised. Well, we are bringing
Talman and a chassid of his brother, in order to
have a whole group from Odessa
for the purpose of Karnak.
If that's something I did special, I raised in memory of someone. The last time we did, some of the people came
back. So what happened
to you? Totally from
you. Help us, Panosu?
You could read. I don't know. I do not know the history of it, but he is not very happy about it.
So in years, Hashem will be like hopefully around Shavuot.
I'll say to you what Begin said to Sadat. Sadat said to Begin, in 25 years, be total peace. And Begin says, you're an optimist that will all be around. So you're saying, Shuat, let's hope the state is standing. We're standing.
Yes,
you got to survive the election.
Regards to Malta.
Thank you. Oh, it's good to see you. I'm going to be in your neighborhood, actually,
okay,
on Tuesday. I hope to daven Maariv.
You have an interest in reading your biography?
That's at Wikipedia.
Yeah. I'm visiting my great grandchild.
I have a problem. I can't print anything else.
This Tuesday.
Oh, well, I should be there. I should be there tomorrow. All things being equal, if my grandson has probably, I'll try to daven him early in the Stiblach. Because he davens mincha at the university, and then we'll take me to Maariv in what the prima levi.
Last week, did you have a printout of the Muhammad Rahoel or an article on Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman?
What do you mean a printout?
Did you type? You have a tip from the internet? I was listening.
No, I have it here in my... Oh. I have it here. It's in my notes. Here, take 1 second.